From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember actress and teacher Uta Hagen. She played Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and was Blanche opposite Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire. She died on Wednesday at the age of 84. Also, playwright Neil Simon. He wrote Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, The Out-of-Towners, and Lost in Yonkers, for which he won a Pulitzer. A remake of his film The Goodbye Girl, starring Jeff Daniels, airs this weekend on TNT. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new comedy, Along Came Polly. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has bypassed the Senate by using a so-called recess appointment to put a controversial judge on the Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans. By appointing Mississippi Judge Charles Pickering while the Senate is not in session, the president avoided Democratic opponents who've blocked the nomination for 2 years. President Bush has praised Pickering as a highly qualified nominee, but civil rights groups say he's racially insensitive. They cite Pickering's public support for a convicted cross burner and say he was hostile to civil rights when he was a Mississippi state legislator. The recess appointment will keep Pickering on the appeals court until the current congressional term ends in January of next year. The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to block a redistricting plan in Texas that Republicans hope will give them 6 or more additional seats in Congress. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The GOP redistricting plan was the result of a bitter legislative fight, which involved Democratic legislators fleeing the state twice to avoid a vote. The court's action will allow congressional elections to proceed this year using the new district map. Republicans think they can win 22 of the state's 32 congressional seats under the plan. They now hold 16 seats. A panel of federal judges upheld the Republican redistricting map last week, saying there was no evidence it was illegal or unconstitutional. The Supreme Court will decide later this year whether to hear an appeal by congressional Democrats who say the plan hurts minority voting rights. But the court refused an emergency request to block the plan from going into effect before the state's primaries on March 9th. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
In Virginia, 2 more defendants have pleaded guilty to involvement in a plot to train for terrorist attacks. The government says the 2 are part of a larger conspiracy to attack targets overseas after September 11th. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Randall Royer and Ibrahim Alhamdi pleaded guilty in federal district court to weapons and explosives charges. They said they helped other defendants travel to a terrorist camp in Pakistan. They were all charged with aiding Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is fighting against India in the disputed region of Kashmir. The government says there were a total of 11 members in what it calls the Virginia Jihad Network, which did part of its training at a paintball field in Northern Virginia. A federal indictment also says the group had broader aims of aiding Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. 4 members of the conspiracy pleaded guilty last year. 4 others are scheduled to go on trial in February and 1 more in March. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 46 points to close at 10,600 in heavy trading. The Dow was up 142 points for the week. The Nasdaq gained 31 points, or about 1.5%, to close at 2,140. This is NPR News. Business inventories rose in November, a sign that manufacturers may be getting ready for higher demand. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The 0.3% rise in business inventories came ahead of the holiday shopping season and was slightly ahead of most analysts' estimates. The report from the Commerce Department also showed sales up 0.5% to just under $880 billion. However, the so-called inventory-to-sales ratio, the amount of time it takes companies to exhaust their supply of unsold goods, still remains at fairly low levels, just over 1.3 months in November. That indicates until businesses are convinced that an economic recovery can be sustained, they are hedging their bets and only producing what they think they can sell. Inventory building by businesses is important since it adds to the overall growth of the economy. The stronger-than-expected rise in inventories in November follows an even larger gain the previous month. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
The Justice Department says it will not try to stop John Hinckley from leaving a mental hospital in Washington, D.C. for unsupervised visits with his parents. Hinckley shot President Reagan in 1981, along with Press Secretary James Brady and two law officers. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity. At a hearing last year, government experts said that Hinckley's mental illness has been in remission for more than 10 years, and a judge decided to allow him to make a series of unsupervised visits to his parents' home in the Washington, D.C. area. The Justice Department said today that it will not appeal the judge's decision, but will try to ensure that there are significant restrictions on Hinckley's movements. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 7 points to close at 1139. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we remember award-winning actress and drama teacher Uta Hagen, who died Wednesday at the age of 84. Uta Hagen was celebrated for a host of stage roles. She played Blanche opposite Marlon Brando Stanley in the 1948 Broadway production of A Streetcar Named Desire. And she won a Tony for her performance as Martha in the 1962 Broadway production of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But within the acting profession, she was known and revered just as much as a teacher. For years, she ran the HB Studio in New York, which was founded by her late husband Herbert Berghoff in 1945. Some of the actors who studied there include Jack Lemmon, Stockard Channing, Matthew Broderick, Maureen Stapleton, and Lily Tomlin. Many actors have studied her books, Respect for Acting and A Challenge for the Actor. Uta Hagen continued teaching after a stroke in 2001 until several months before her death. Terry Gross spoke to Uta Hagen in 1998.
You're known as a great teacher as well as a great actor, and you've written a couple of books about acting. You write that there are hundreds of different people within you who surface through the day, within anyone who surface through the day. Do you recommend that actors find the person within them that's closest to the role that they're playing?
Well, it isn't one person in you. In other words, when you create a role, you are selecting from various aspects of your life and putting it together to create that new character. But all of that has to spring from your understanding of yourself. And that's what takes so long.
You say that an experience that has served you many times, including when you played Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, is an experience from your childhood when you were like pelted with hard snowballs by kids in the neighborhood, and you were called an atheist. What is it from that scene that stayed with you so much, from that experience? And
well, it was a bitter, cold winter night. I was hounded through the streets with snowballs by children. That's terrifying. I never forgot it. It was like being in hell.
What is it from that experience that you summon up when you need to for a role?
I don't know.
Okay. Mm. I'm wondering if there is a kind of experience that is so frightening or rich for you, if you've used it to draw on several times for roles, does the experience dry up? Does it lose
No.
its power to
No,
have that energy for you?
As a matter of fact, that experience might wear out because I've talked about it a lot. If you don't talk about it a lot, it stays useful. When you explain to an audience, to somebody, a friend or, a colleague who's working with you, what sources you're using, if you tell them that, your secret is gone. Now they look at you with that knowledge of what you're using and judging it, and you can't use it anymore.
That's interesting. So you won't talk about these things with the people you're performing with?
No.
But you'll talk about it with your students?
Not what I'm using in the immediate role. I give them examples like the snowball.
Right.
Now that's used up for me because I've talked about it a lot.
In one of your books about acting, you talk about how you can't be inert on stage, and you have to find out what it is that you actually do while you think you're doing nothing, so that you could do that kind of thing on stage. Have you thought about that a lot, what it is you're doing when you're not really doing
anything? I'm going
to
interrupt you right now.
Go ahead.
Because, again, everything you're discussing, you have read, it interests you. Are you an actor?
No, I'm not.
Then it's none of your business. Now, let me explain to you why. It may interest you, may fascinate you, but if You see, I feel that in the theater, everybody thinks they can act. Everybody is fascinated about another human being on stage. If it's very convincing, they usually are sure that they could do it too, which is not true at all. If you would go to a violinist, you would not ask him about his bowing arm, about his elbow position, about his phrasing. And if he told you, you wouldn't know what he's talking about, and you would be bored. If you went to a painting class and a watercolor class, and you saw a teacher showing somebody how to put how to wash a piece of paper that is going to have watercolor put on it in a minute, you'd say, "What do they teach here? How they're watering down a page?" These are not the secrets, but the craft itself. You wouldn't ask a scientist because you wouldn't know what he was talking about. And you must, I feel, an audience should learn to respect acting as a craft in the same way that if I do explain it, it'll might titillate you. You might understand a little of it, but the real impact or import of it for a fellow artist, you would not get.
I don't
say that to offend you. I just believe that with all my heart.
I want to say I totally respect what you're saying, but I just beg to differ on a couple of things. That, for example, I would be asking the violinist about their phrasing and the bend of their arm and all of that.
Why?
Well, because I
think... Do you play violin?
No, but...
Then I think you might ask him, but I think the violinist would look at you like you were nuts, and I think you are.
No, see, what I have found as someone very... interested in these things is that, for instance, if the violinist talks to me about his or her phrasing, it might help me hear music, hear things in music that I didn't hear before. I find that actually understanding more about craft is not only interesting in its own right, but helps me perceive things that I didn't perceive before, which I like.
That's a very valid point. And maybe I'm just in reaction to so many people who ask these questions the misunderstanding of the layman in terms of an acting technique are so profound that I think I've pretty much had it in my life with that. I think that's probably part of my rebellion.
I'll tell you another reason why I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about acting, though I respect you for not wanting to talk about this, is that I think really good actors have great insights into the body and how the body is used, how the body communicates, how the voice communicates, and also that great actors are great observers of other people, and they just have great insights into...
That's true.
How
and
people
I think,
move.
But you see, the body again, which I'm gung ho about, mm-hmm. I'm talking about it all the time, and I believe that the body as a instrument of communication is all powerful. And the biggest influence in my life for that training came from modern dance, without being balletic or dancerish, but it very strongly influenced me. However, very fine actors very often cannot define themselves what it is they are doing. Lorette Taylor could not tell you what she was doing. She had no idea. She was intuitive, instinctive, great performer.
I've certainly noticed that as an interviewer, that some of the really great artists I've interviewed...
Oh, God, some of the best ones
right.
And I happen to have because I've been teaching, and I found in my own work that very often... when I couldn't explain something, it was because I didn't understand it myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I couldn't articulate it, it was because it was fuzzy in my own head. Now, I do know that I can do it, nevertheless, but I may not be able to communicate it to someone else.
I know that you've recommended singing lessons for people who aren't necessarily going to be singing on stage, but are just going to be speaking. What do you feel you've learned about your voice from... studying singing? I'm assuming you've studied it.
I did. You see, it's the same with when I say dance, modern
mm-hmm.
dance, for
mm-hmm.
the body of the actor, which does not make them self-conscious about stage movement, but gives them a sense of alignment, a sense of an awareness of their body and space. In the same way, singing, rather than voice for the theater, makes them not listen to themselves. It prepares the vocal instrument, the diaphragm, the the whole tone of the voice in the head. Without making you now listen to yourself when you talk. Do you understand what I mean? The self-consciousness, when it makes you listen how it sounds, you're going to be a bad actor. The voice has to be there for you, to serve you when the time comes.
Right. So you're not worrying about how you're doing your lines.
You're
learning about the sound and physicality of your voice.
Exactly. It's there from the singing. It serves, the instrument is ready. It's primed.
Your acting career was launched by what I perceive to be as a very bold gesture. When you were, I think, 17, you wrote a letter to Eve Le Gallienne asking if you could work with her.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very brave thing to do.
I didn't even think it was brave. I was also very stupid. I thought she still had the civic repertory, which I knew, had read a great deal about and heard about. And it was the only repertory company in America at the time, or there hasn't been one since, I don't think, a real repertory company. And she was doing great plays and contemporary new playwrights and Ibsen and Chekhov and Shakespeare, and that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be a part of that. And based on that, I wrote her and I said, this is what I want, and could I audition for you, and I want to be a part of your theater. And didn't realize that the Civic had already folded, and she was still functioning, but not in that capacity. And then she was working on a production of Hamlet, and which I didn't know. And I went home after my audition with her, and in spring of 36, no, 37, and then I was, my father wanted me to go to college, and because at that time you couldn't get a job at Macy's if you didn't have a degree. It was during the Depression. And I was itching to just go into the theater. I didn't want to do college. So I thought I'll do it in a 3-year plan and take summer school. And I went to enroll in summer school and came home, and there was a letter from Miss Le Gallienne asking if I would be interested in coming east and working with her on Hamlet. And that was my debut in the theater, Ophelia.
Now, was that letter based on her having seen you, or just based on your letter?
No, based on my letter.
What?
My letter to her.
What did you say in that letter?
I don't know.
That led to that invitation.
I really don't know how. I used to persuade people that I was fabulous because I guess I believed it. And I don't know how I interested. My agent said to me, who was my agent at the time, she said, I don't know, when you walked in, you knew you were great, so we believed it. And I don't think I had egomania at all. I just believed I had a big talent and I was going to be a great actress.
So what was it like for you playing Ophelia so early in your career?
I don't remember. You see, it's all like a haze and blur. It was a wonderful experience. And then in essence, I studied with her because I worked with her in the play and that whole company with fencing lessons, and we had all sorts of extracurricular things we were asked to do. And we wove our own costumes at her looms. And it was a phenomenal experience for me. And then when that was finished, which went very well at Dennis, we played it in Dennis, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and got wonderful reviews from Elliot Norton and all the fine Boston critics. And then she was going to do eight plays in repertory and work on it for 3 years. She had a huge grant for that, and I was going to be part of that. And then I rehearsed with her for 3 months, and she abandoned the whole thing because she felt the company wasn't good enough, which I don't think it was. And so I worked with her on The Seagull. I worked with her in other roles in the fall. And then at Christmas, the whole thing was collapsed. And then I went on to do The Seagull with the Lunts. I don't believe it. When I laugh, it's because it's like some fairy tale.
Actress and drama teacher Uta Hagen speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Hagen died Wednesday at the age of 84. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with award-winning actress and drama teacher Uta Hagen, who died on Wednesday.
Did you ever study, you know, the method?
No, never. I mean, I've read all of Stanislavski's books avidly when I was young, and I still have my old copies that are all underlined with "so true" on the side, you know? I didn't really know why. And I also remember thinking, why can't I do what he's telling me when I get on stage? As a matter of fact, that when I was asked to write my book, I was actually commissioned to write the first one by Macmillan. I said, it can't be done, because, and it drove me crazy, because I said, I can demonstrate something in 1 second that it takes me 30 pages to write. You know, got so bored with it. But there are... My books are actually based on things that gave me problems as an actor. Mm-hmm. And every exercise, every thing I came up with was based on my own problems, sharing those with other actors, which I think most of those problems every actor has had himself. When people say, oh, how do you know that? I say, because there isn't a mistake I haven't made. There isn't a mistake in the book that I haven't made 10 times, 100 times. So then I see it in someone else, then I can help them get rid of that problem.
In 1943, you played Desdemona to Paul Robeson's Othello. What was it like to work opposite Robeson?
Well, it was wonderful. He was an unbelievably overused term, but charismatic man with a great presence, an enormous intelligence, a sense of humor. He was a great, great man.
Was there anything that was considered controversial about the production?
Everything was considered controversial. That's why.
Because so often Othello was played by a white actor in blackface.
It was the first time in this country. No, mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe in some. I just was trying to think who else had played it. I don't want to have history cockeyed here, but it was for a Broadway production. Way ahead of its time in that sense, and that made it very controversial and very exciting, and no trouble at all. Everybody was thrilled with the idea that this was finally happening.
Now, am I right in saying that you were later blacklisted?
Oh, yes, I was blacklisted for 10 years.
And
as a matter of fact, I was graylisted in 1970. I did a production for CBS, and I said, there was a woman producer called Barbara Schultz, and I said, did you have any trouble getting me on? And she said, oh, God, yes. That was still in 1970.
And do you think that related at all to your work with Robeson?
It did.
And your friendship with Robeson?
It did, no question about it. I also was a progressive and a political, I still call myself a liberal, left liberal Democrat. I always was, and I always will be. And it was that one time in my life when I would say I was very proud to be an American citizen, because I felt I was very active as such. And the blacklisting and the what happened to me as a result, I say the government still owes me an apology.
So you lost a lot of roles that you think
well,
you would have had.
Well, of course. Yeah. Oh, I know. And it was at the kind of the most fruitful part of my career. I had just done... Blanche for 2 years. I had done The Country Girl. I had done St. Joan. And suddenly, and I was beginning to get big television offers. I never got another television. I never got another film offer. St. Joan was supposed to go on the road. I couldn't go on the road because they were writing the Guild protest letters from Indianapolis, from all over the country. And And the worst thing they did, I don't really care, I say, about that, because I think, in a way, maybe it prevented me from being tempted by movies and stuff that I would have been sorry I did afterwards. But what they did to me spiritually was that it's the only time in my life I was ever frightened. I've never been frightened of anything in my life. And that scared me, and that's what I resent most.
Did you have to testify?
Twice. I mean, I was called twice. I only testified once eventually in private session. But those were horrible days. Those were days when you sat in a restaurant, and if you started to talk politics, you looked over your shoulder to see if a waiter was listening, was going to report you. My phone was tapped. I was followed by the FBI. And nobody ever even asked me to be a communist. That's what's so ironic about that whole time.
You met your late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in the theater. He was an actor and teacher, and you run the studio that he founded. Did you meet him in a play? Were you on stage together?
Yes,
first?
We were in a play with Klerman, as a matter of fact. It was the same play. Called The Whole World Over by Konstantin Simonov. Not a very good play. And he was a replacement. And I had heard about him, and through many of my acting colleagues, many of them studied with him. I thought he was a phony, he was a guru. At the few meetings I had with him, I thought he was a strange man. And then we started working together, and were love scenes, and a couple of kisses, and a couple of hugs, and a week later we hit the sack and we never left.
Now, 44
years later.
I imagine it's a very kind of intensified experience to be in love with somebody on and off stage, to enact this dramatic love on stage and to also feel it off stage.
I don't think it's that so much. It's working together. I think it needn't have been a love scene for us to fall in love with each other.
Uh-huh.
But what was extraordinary about our relationship from then on was that we truly did everything together. I mean, we had he'd got me into teaching. He's the one who started me teaching. And I said, I don't know how to teach. Why do you want me to teach? And he said, you know how to act. Can't you learn to pass on what you've learned? And when he put it that way, I thought, that'll be fun. And then from then on, I loved it. And we had the studio together, and we played together for many, many years. And he directed me in many plays. And it was a unique, fabulous life that I still can't believe is gone.
Actress and drama teacher Uta Hagen speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Uta Hagen died Wednesday. She was 84. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from the Sundance Channel, celebrating the 2004 Sundance Film Festival with 8 days of past festival films and original programming, starting Saturday, January 17th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, playwright Neil Simon. He wrote Barefoot in the Park, Lost in Yonkers, and The Odd Couple. A remake of his film The Goodbye Girl airs this weekend on TNT. And David Edelstein reviews the new comedy Along Came Polly, starring Ben Stiller and Jennifer Aniston.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon has made a lot of people laugh. He started his career in the early days of television, writing for Sid Caesar's Show, Phil Silver's Sergeant Bilko, and The Gary Moore Show. But his real ambition was to write plays, and he lit up Broadway with a string of hits, including Come Blow Your Horn, Barefoot in the Park, Plaza Suite, Prisoner of Second Avenue, The Sunshine Boys, The Goodbye Girl, California Suite, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Biloxi Blues, and Laughter on the 23rd Floor. He also wrote the book for the musical Sweet Charity and Promises, Promises. Simon adapted many of his plays into successful films. The Odd Couple became a popular movie and TV series, and his stage hit The Goodbye Girl is now in its second film incarnation, this one a made-for-TV movie starring Jeff Daniels and Patricia Heaton. It premieres this weekend on the cable channel TNT. Here's a clip from the 1977 film adaptation of The Goodbye Girl, starring Richard Dreyfuss and Marsha Mason. Dreyfuss plays an actor who's arrived in New York thinking he's sublet an apartment. When he arrives, he's surprised to find it's occupied by Mason and her daughter.
So what's the deal, huh? I mean, I got a lease here in my pocket. You gonna honor it or what?
I got a daughter in my bed. That tops a lease in your pocket.
Look, I don't want to get legal. You know, legal happens to be on my side. Now, I happen to have a lawyer acquaintance downtown. Now, all I gotta do is call this lawyer acquaintance of mine.
Oh.
Whoa, whoa, what?
An actor. Another damn actor. I happen to have a lawyer acquaintance. Write out A Streetcar Named Desire. Stanley Kowalski and Summer Stock, right?
Wrong. Chicago in the Dead of Winter. 3.5 months at the Drury Lane Theater.
Ask an actor a question, he gives you his credits.
You want to hear the reviews? Elliot Garfield brings to Kowalski dimensions that even Brando had not investigated.
Terrific! You write beautifully. Aren't you a little short to play Stanley?
Nobody noticed I stood on the poker table. What are you, a critic?
Terry Gross spoke to Neil Simon in 1996 after he'd published his memoir titled Rewrites. She asked how he developed his ear for writing dialogue.
I never thought about it much, but the only thing that came to me is that when I was a young boy, 5 and 6 and 7 years old, my parents would take me to visit their relatives, and for some reason, I think they thought that I was invisible because they never talked to me.
Right, or they talk about you even though you could hear?
I could hear, but they were talking family matters or gossip or whatever, and I just sat there, and once in a while, they'd give me a cookie or something, and I just listened. I wasn't terribly interested, but it stuck in my head. And what I managed to learn was the way they talked, the choice of words they made, what it was that they were interested in. And years later, without knowing it, when I started to write about these people, I was able to draw on my own memory from what happened in those days.
Early on in your career, your brother Danny was your writing partner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, what, about 8 years older?
Eight and a half years old, yes.
Yeah. And you write in your book that he was somewhere between your brother and your father. He was your mentor as well as your
mm-hmm.
brother. And your father actually was in and out of the family. He left the family and came back, I think, about 8 times.
Exactly, yes.
Was it strange to have him coming and going like that, not knowing exactly what his relationship to you was?
It was awful because I felt my life was sort of on a yo-yo, to give my kind of example. My mother never knew when he was coming back, and the whole world lit up when he came back, because it meant not only did we not have to fear for the rent because he didn't leave any money for us, we didn't have to worry about food, but I felt a solidity there with the family, and I felt happy for my mother. When he was gone, it was the most awful time, and I thought he was never coming back. And I'm sure a lot of my personality has been formed by that relationship. And it makes me somewhat insecure at times. And it's why I think I fell back on writing, possibly, as a way of being able to support and survive for myself.
I imagine your mother, when your father was gone, ended up very busy with earning money to take care of the family. And
yes, she was uneducated. Mm-hmm. She did not have a job, and she would do whatever she could to provide for us. She borrowed from her family, but what she eventually did, which was the hardest thing for us, was she took in 2 men to live in our house, 2 boarders, who took her bedroom, and she slept on the sofa in the living room. My brother and I had our own bedroom, and they were butchers, and they paid us mostly in meat and lamb chops.
Gee.
It was And it was no fun sitting at the room in the kitchen eating with them.
Why not?
They were like strangers. They didn't talk to us. They were mostly foreigners. And I don't mean mostly foreigners. They were foreign and spoke some English. But it was difficult, and it was not my father. And I felt I was living in not my house, but their house.
You know, the stereotype of the Jewish mother of your mother's generation was of the overly possessive, overly neurotic Jewish mother, right? I imagine your mother was much too busy.
She was.
To fit that stereotype at all.
No, I don't think she did fit that stereotype. She was very different. She was very loving and very encouraging in terms of my brother and I doing the writing. My brother, foolishly, I think, would read the monologues that we would write at first to my mother, and she would just laugh all the way through. And my brother said, "Do you understand what they mean?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, why are you laughing?" She says, "Well, it pleases me to please you." I mean, it was such a wonderful thing for her to do. It didn't encourage us as writers, but it encouraged us that we had a terrific mother.
You write that your brother got you a whore shortly after your 21st birthday, and that was your sexual initiation.
Yes, it was.
Looking back, was that a good way to become initiated?
I don't know if it was a good way. It was the only way. I mean, if he left it to me, I'd be 54 before it happened. I'm sure glad it did happen, but it did change me. I mean, you have to get through that moment. Because it was the most fearful moment of my life, and I don't know why it is, looking back. I mean, that you don't expect this woman to think that you should be expert at what you're doing or that this is going to be a very personal affair and that we should like each other. It's really a cash-and-carry business, and you just do it. But I felt so much better having done it and that I would never have to do it that way again, which I never did.
There's a similar but different scene in Biloxi Blues where the character there also has his first experience with a prostitute, but that's on an army base, so it's...
Yeah, but the origin of that scene in that film was exactly what happened to me. I mean, it was with a prostitute.
Yeah.
It was his fellow friends bringing him there, but there was a line in it that summed it up, because I felt the same way when it happened to me. He said, I'm not expecting this to be a pleasurable experience. I just want to get through it.
Neil Simon speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Here's that scene they were talking about from the 1988 film Biloxi Blues.
A half an hour he's been in there. If he doesn't hurry up, I'm going to pass my peak.
Hey, what if she's ugly? I mean, really ugly.
Then you close your eyes and you think of some cheerleader.
I don't want to close my eyes. That's the same as doing it to yourself.
Not if you're feeling someone underneath you or on top of you.
On top of me? Would be on top of me.
She would. She could be anywhere. Under a table, on a chair, or an ironing board.
On an ironing board? What kind of a girl is this? I thought we were going to a regular place.
Don't you know anything?
Maybe not an actual experience. But I have all the information I need.
Do you know how many positions there are?
American or worldwide? This guy is a riot.
We'll hear more from Neil Simon after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon.
What was Broadway like when you first got there?
It was great. There were, I would say, a minimum of 20 plays on Broadway. I think today you'd be lucky to find 5 plays on Broadway. When I say a minimum, I think maybe there'd be 30. And if you would count the amount of plays that were there during the entire season, the plays that failed and moved on or had run its run from the year before. So there could be 40 plays on Broadway. Actors were always acting. Once a play closed, they auditioned for another play. And so it was not a place that I felt I was not going to be able to break into. There was a long road to do it because I had to write a play and get it past the producers. I showed the first play, Come Blow Your Horn, to many producers, about 10 or 12 of the best of them, David Merrick and Garson Kanin and some of the best-known people in the theater. They gave me wonderful tips about writing the plays, but they didn't want to put on a Come Blow Your Horn. They didn't think it was experienced enough, and so the only way I could save it was by going to summer stock to the Bucks County Playhouse in New Hope, Pennsylvania. We put it on there. It was sort of a success, but it wasn't there all the way through, and so the producers there said if I took 6 months and rewrote it and they liked the rewrite, they would put it on Broadway. But it was a glorious time on Broadway then, and I'm sorry to see it not the same way.
What's changed? What was once there that you miss now?
The accessibility of seeing the best actors in the business. There was Henry Fonda and any other number of wonderful actors who would come from Hollywood each year to do it. When the difference in salaries didn't seem to mean anything, but now an actor in one television series could make enough in that one series, if it ran 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, to last him his life. He never had to work again. We've lost all of those actors, lost them from the theater. Very hard to get somebody who would come back and do a play. You do occasionally, but it's few and far between.
Let me ask you about creating two of your most famous characters, Felix and Oscar, the odd couple.
Yes.
How did you come up with those characters?
Well, I just watched it in real life. It was my brother, Danny, and a friend of his named Roy Gerber, both of whom moved in together in the same apartment because they recently were divorced. And they wanted to cut down on their expenses so they could help pay their alimony. And in their social life, rather than going out on a double date somewhere and spending a lot of money on the dinner, my brother Danny decided to cook. And Roy was kind of a, you know, things came and go very easily for him. So he would just say to the girls, come up for dinner. Come, you know, 6:30, 7, 7:30, whenever you're ready. Well, to Danny, that was anathema. I mean, he cooked the pot roast that night. He wanted them there at 7:30. And I watched this one night. I came up to Danny's apartment and Roy's apartment. I saw this taking place as they were getting prepared for this dinner. I was going to leave before the dinner happened. And it was hilarious to me. And I said, Danny, this is a great movie, a great play, something. You must write it, because Danny was a writer too. But he never wrote by himself. And he started to write the play, but he took 3 months or so to write 10 pages and finally called me and he said, I can't do it. He says, I'm not a writer and I'm certainly not a playwright. He is a writer, of course, but he was not a playwright and he didn't know how to construct it. And he said, you take the play and you do it. And so I made a financial arrangement with him because it was his basic, it wasn't his idea to do it as a play, but it was his life, so I was taking a part of it. When I wrote the play in the beginning, I thought I was writing a very dark comedy. I didn't think it was going to be as funny as it was dark, because here was a man who was broken up with his wife that he loved dearly, and he had to leave his two children at home, and he was almost suicidal. Whereas Roy was another kind of character who was, I mean, the character that Roy was based on, the Oscar character, was a man who couldn't really keep his life going together, didn't know how to take care of his children's goldfish when they left. And so I thought I was writing, as I said, this grim comedy until I gave it to Bob Fosse, a good friend of mine who lived in the same building, to read. And he says, this is the funniest play I've ever read. And I said, you don't find it dark? And he said, no, not at all. So the author is not always sure about what impression he's going to leave when he writes this thing.
Now, how'd you feel about The Odd Couple when it became a TV series, where instead of like a constructed play every week, there was another little adventure or mishap to write
well,
around?
Well, I have to preface that by telling you the story, which you may have read in the book, that I had a business agent who thought he was doing me a favor by getting a deal made with Paramount Pictures, whereby they would buy this little company from me for $125,000, which seemed like an enormous amount of money, in which they got all of the TV and television rights to The Odd Couple. So I never saw a penny of any of The Odd Couple television series. So I could not watch that. I didn't watch that for 2 years, because when I saw that it was a hit, I saw that's my money going down their drain.
Right.
And I also lost all of the stage rights of Barefoot in the Park. Never made a penny on that play from the day it opened. And so so I looked at that as a very bad experience, and it was hard for me to watch the show until I finally did see it about 2 years after it was running, and I saw how good it was. It was really good. Didn't do me any good, but it's okay for them.
Oh, boy, what heartburn it must cause to feel that you almost don't want to see the success of your own work because you're not getting anything out of it.
I know. It was hard, but maybe just pushed me on to do other things, and I said, I've got to get on with this. I'm not going to sit and just gripe about it for the rest of my life, and I just went on to write other plays.
You write a little bit in your book about being in analysis, and you say that your first year of analysis was, in a sense, an attempt to introduce you to yourself, the two sides of you, one the writer and the other the person who doesn't write. Are these two sides of you at odds?
Well, they have been for years. They weren't always at odds. They were just different people. They were not the person that I was with my family, with my friends. The writer is a very solitary person who is, I guess in the worst sense, willing to pick the bones of somebody else's character and put it up there on the stage, even though I don't think I've ever hurt anybody by doing it, because no one ever came up to me and said, how dare you put this up there on the stage. As a matter of fact, when I put my father up on the stage and Come Blow Your Horn, he came to see it, and I was very fearful of what he was going to say. And I said, what'd you think, Dad? And he says, oh, I know men just like that. He never saw himself in it at all, which is what most people do. Sometimes they people come up to me and they say, that was me you were writing about, wasn't it? And it wasn't at all anything that I was writing about. So about the two Neil Simons, yes. The writer was persistent. He just always wanted to write. The other person wanted to have more fun, more leisure time, more time with his family. And so they were at odds. But I find as time goes on, right about now, maybe as we're talking, that the two characters are becoming more wed to each other. I don't see the disparity in the two personalities anymore. It sounds like I'm a little psychotic, but I'm not, really.
Well, maybe that's because the two have lived together for so long, they've become more acclimated to each other.
I know. I'm my own odd couple.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Did analysis help?
Well, analysis, I think, helps in the long run. I never went for, like, long, long periods at a time. I would go from time to time when there was great trouble in my life, when my first wife died, when I had other personal problems. But after a while, I started to go because it was a way of learning about myself and about learning about other people, because the conversations were not only about this Neil Simon character. It was about how they are affected by other people in the world. And once you get into that subject, you start to talk about the other people in the world, and you realize that you do not live alone in this world. So it was very educational for me. I graduated, got a diploma. It was very nice.
Was it helpful for you as a writer to introspect out loud like that?
I think so. The one thing it helped me to do was open myself up to a complete stranger, because I went to different analysts during my life, and I never had any trouble doing it. I know people who would say, oh, I would never tell that to my analyst. And I said, what are you going for? I was never afraid that they were going to betray my privacy or that they were going to dig too deep. I was sometimes afraid that I was going to go someplace that was so dark and deep in myself that it might throw me. But it never did. I never found that place that was so awful. I just realized that I was human and I was subject to human experiences and troubles and travails and a lot of happiness. If anything, the analysts may have taught me to try to enjoy my life so much. One of them said, Neil, you don't enjoy your successes long enough. And I said, well, you mean a play? And she says, yes. I mean, you go around for about 3 or 4 days and say, this is great. And then you just go back to work and you forget about it. And I said, well, you have to tell me how long I'm supposed to enjoy myself. it's work to me, and I enjoy the work, so I'm enjoying the work more than I am the success.
You also had claustrophobia, right?
I did, yes. Strangely, it just went away. I don't know. I couldn't get on planes. I couldn't get on elevators. And
well, didn't you live in an apartment building? Didn't you live in an apartment, like a high-rise?
In New York?
Yeah.
Yes, but not while I had claustrophobia. I
mean, otherwise you'd be taking the stairs a lot.
Yes, when I was growing up in New York, we lived on the third floor, so I walked up there. When I did live in a building that had an elevator, if it had an elevator, man, then I was all right. Once the push buttons came in, I was getting kind of scared. But it just disappeared one day. I couldn't get on a plane without a drink or something like that, or a pill. That went away as well. I sometimes can get it. I don't like driving in a car where I have to, that's a two-door car, and I have to sit in the back. And that it all has to do with control. It means I am at the whim of the person driving the car. If I say, stop the car, I want to get out, and he says, no, I'm stuck back there. So I need control over my life, which is why I think one of the reasons I became a writer, because while I'm in that room, nobody can say, no, that's not good, you can't do that.
Well, Neil Simon, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. His play, The Goodbye Girl, has been adapted to film for a second time. This one is a made-for-TV movie starring Jeff Daniels and Patricia Heaton, which airs this weekend on TNT. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new romantic comedy Along Came Polly. This is Fresh Air. Ben Stiller and Jennifer Aniston star in the new romantic comedy Along Came Polly. In the film, Stiller and Aniston play an unlikely pair. He's uptight and she's a free spirit. Film critic David Edelstein says that if the filmmakers were trying to model the classic screwball comedies of the past, they haven't done their homework.
Ben Stiller has a great comic shtick. It always makes me laugh, even when I'm watching it for the third or fourth or 50th time in the same movie. Even when the movie, like Along Came Polly, could be the basis of a course called Ben Stiller 101, Screwball Romance in the Age of Pandering Gross-Out Comedies. Stiller plays little guys who are perpetually humiliated, but he's no Charlie Chaplin or Stan Laurel. He isn't serene, and he doesn't take injustice in stride. Stiller burns with outrage. He also, and here's his real problem, burns with shame. And, of course, he's surrounded by shameless extroverts, not unlike his dad, Jerry Stiller, come to think of it, who exhort him to throw away his inhibitions and act, a scenario that always ends in Stiller following their advice and ending up even more pathetically exposed. The writer and director of Along Came Polly is John Hamburg, who has become a specialist in Stiller-esque humiliation gags. He wrote Meet the Parents and Zoolander, and for his directorial debut, he's come up with a textbook screwball scenario. A repressed insurance risk analyst is forced to loosen up when he becomes involved with a flake who runs from scheduling and commitment. I'd like to say there are one or two more nuances here, but that's essentially it, folks. Here's what I think of as the thesis scene between Stiller's Reuben Pfeffer, whose wife left him on the first day of their honeymoon, for a muscle-bound French scuba diver, and Jennifer Aniston as Polly, the movie's resident free spirit.
I'm just really truthfully not the kind of guy that's ever going to be into these kind of clubs or anything.
Okay, Reuben, you know, then tell me, what kind of guy are you?
What kind of guy am I?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, up until now, you haven't exactly been the portrait of honesty, so just come clean, okay? Just tell me who you are.
I hate spicy food.
I knew it!
Yeah, I don't like it at all. I have a mild case of IBS and
what is that?
Irritable bowel syndrome.
What?
Irritable bowel syndrome?
Oh, God.
Oh.
That's terrible. What else?
Look, the thing is, I assess risk for a living, so I know that I have a 0.013% chance of being hit by a car on my way home, or a 1 in 46,000 chance of falling through a subway grate.
Really?
So I try to manage that risk by avoiding danger and having a plan and knowing what my next move is. And I guess you don't exactly live your life that way.
No, I do it. I do it a little differently.
Yeah, which is great, but I'm not going to ever be a dirty dancer, and I don't eat food with my hands, and I really like you, but I just don't think this is going to work out.
That last sound, by the way, is the two of them crashing through the door of her apartment on their way to bed. Their first coupling is pretty funny, and there's a good monologue by Stiller about how a bowl of mixed nuts in a bar is like a hot zone of Ebola. But the modern screwball comedy has a cheaper and easier source of gags than its classic predecessors, like Bringing Up Baby and The Lady Eve, which were almost mythic in the way they showed people afraid of their own sexuality being shocked into going with the flow. The 21st century repressed screwball hero has a more basic struggle. He tries to hide his sexual urges, which means he's always getting caught ejaculating. He tries to hide his bowels, which means he has expulsive diarrhea. Now, learning to adjust to your own and other people's bodily excretions isn't a minor issue in life, but it's not exactly the breakthrough that leads to mature love, which was the subject of those classic screwball comedies. On the level of storytelling, the movie is cruder yet. Along Came Polly is one of those films that celebrate spontaneity and risk-taking, yet are so formulaic and unrisky that they strangle their own message. It's so generic that half an hour after it's over, the only thing you'll remember are the actors, Stiller doing his angry, squirmy thing, and Philip Seymour Hoffman channeling Chris Farley, which is demeaning for an actor of his stature, but more subtle than the original God Rest His Soul. Jennifer Aniston is surprisingly good here, throaty and soft and slightly detached. She resists the impulse to be a zany and hits a couple of authentically weird notes. The best thing in the movie, though, is Alec Baldwin as Ruben's boss, the kind of guy who slaps Ruben's bottom for emphasis when Ruben is standing at the urinal. Baldwin is enormous here, with a voice that sounds an octave lower than usual, and his comic spirit is outsized, too. From the wreckage of his career as a leading man, he's fast becoming one of the premier character actors of his generation, a man whose comfort in his own expanding flesh is a lesson to screwball comedy heroes everywhere.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillick directed today's show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The 37th Hour, a novel of suspense by Jodi Compton that follows a missing persons cop searching for her missing lover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Shirley Ann Barnhart was a child, she had a crush on the 19-year-old preacher in her church. He was known as ML, but later he became Martin Luther King Jr. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Barnhart, and we'll listen to King's speeches with Claiborne Carson of the King Papers Project. Join us for the next Fresh Air.